Can we have some responses, please? Right. And I see it's Liam Youngs. Oh,
yeah. Andy was first, I think.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Andrew Davis goes first. Okay, Andrew, over to you.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm happy to let the other comrade come in before me. I talk a lot at these meetings, so anybody that speaks, I'm always grateful to hear them.
Ah. Hey, Darren, it's back to you. Andrew,
is it Darren O'Neill?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
It's a question for, I guess, Mike, or for anybody that's listening, because I have the same experience as Mike on YouTube where, funny enough, we kind of watch the same videos, but we seem to also receive these push recommendations for right-wing videos, alt-right-wing videos, Jordan Peterson, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just curious if Mike knows or if anybody in the meeting knows, is there some kind of, do people actually know if there's a genuine policy by these companies, YouTube or whatever, because they understand this content generates controversy, generates kind of interaction and feedback. Are they going out of their way to push this stuff, whether or not you're looking for it or not? Because I'm intrigued by this. You know, occasionally I might have clicked on it once, but like I'm like Mike, I'm like watching like 70s and 80s stuff, 90s. Music or football, etc., you know, Play for Today. I'm in no way looking for Jordan Peterson's opinion on Sesame Street, which is why he's trending on Twitter / X today. So does anybody know if there's some kind of secret memo basically saying, well, this is, you know, if we push this thing for people, you know, it'll actually get us more clicks, more revenue, etc., etc.? Because it really is kind of dangerous. You know, I'm just curious if anybody knows. Thank you.
Anybody would like to respond to what Darren had to say there? No? Okay, then. Right. Back to Andrew then. Andrew, away you go.
Thanks, Brian. And can everybody hear me okay? Yeah? Okay. Thanks, Mike. That was a very interesting talk. For myself, I'm not very savvy at all with political social media. Well, barely at all. You know, I've got no idea about it. And the sort of YouTube experience that I have is usually just one of sort of, you know, just having a nice time watching old videos of The Who on stage or The Two Ronnies or, you know, Dick Emery Show or something like that. It's not really anything to do with what you were talking about. And even the people that I look after in the care home that I run, you know, they have learning disabilities. And so they watch YouTube, but they're generally sort of quite benign cartoons and so on. So it's interesting that this YouTube now has become a platform in its own way for some of these people. I've heard some of the names, you know. I wouldn't be able to say very much about them at all. But just in a broader context for your talk, you know, and to my own understanding and try to sort of situate some of this stuff in a more kind of from a socialist perspective and possibly even from I'm not a sociologist, but from possibly a sociological perspective. I think it goes back, I think, to the 1970s when, you know, we sort of the Western societies started to experience, well, I think it started in 1972 or 73 with the oil price shock and the sort of follow-on from the Suez Crisis and all that type of thing. But there was a gradual process that started to kick in at that time, where technology was speeding up. And there was basically a deindustrialization process occurred in Western societies. And so it affected a lot of white men who at that time, you know, we all know people, I do anyway, I'm old enough to remember my granddad and all his friends who were kind of veterans of the Second World War and all that type of thing. But basically there was a sort of a gradual process of what we could call this is a very, very broad and sweeping term, but effectively the feminization of work. You know, this idea that manual labor was no longer so important. It's not wholly true. You still need big, strong blokes to put up scaffolding, and mostly you might have big, strong women who can do it as well. But, you know, generally speaking, those are still sort of traditionally male roles. But the whole male female like divide, you know, I can't think of the right words right now, in work started to erode, which then sort of kicked into something which I think in the 1980s, 90s, some intellectuals started to discuss as a gradual creeping crisis of masculinity. And so we sort of gradually then this all coalesced with, with a gradual sort of idea. You know, I think it was Francis Fukuyama came up with the idea, you know, the end of history, and Thatcher coming up with the term, there is no alternative, Tina, you know, there's no alternative to the market. You just have to accept your lot, and that's how it's going to be. Which in many ways then drove a sort of process, which we've come to now, really. But I don't think will last for very much longer, of basic sort of individuation, atomization, society, you know, just really sort of crumbling, basically. It's certainly in Western terms. But it also seems then, and I am trying to stay on point, Mike, about the talk here, because I think it does tie in with where these guys are at, you know, that you were explaining to us, that the left, you know, the left wing of the political kind of scene, you know, in sort of the mainstream, don't any longer defend the working class. They'll defend minorities within the working class, which is basically, you know, about identity politics. And that's something that really has, you know, worried me a lot over the past probably 10 years or so. And I see that this sort of right-wing reaction to the left is sort of understandable in that context, because all the identity politics sort of stuff that the left now are defending are then taken up as sort of straw dogs for these sort of provocateurs. I don't necessarily think they're right wing, really. I think they're just sort of, well, frankly, idiots, but also just people who want to make a name for themselves by being outrageous. So if you can, you know, sort of say and do outrageous things, I mean, Russell Brand's an example of that, probably. Other people who are still in the mainstream who should probably be, you know, hauled over the coals just the same way as Russell Brand, Jonathan Ross probably, and various others like that who facilitated all of that type of behaviour should. And that's brought this thing to what in America certainly is called the culture wars. So it's a natural clash. In the absence of any substantial content to fight for, which is effectively, you know, the emancipation of the working class, it just sets people against each other because people have forgotten that. But the only thing I will say is I don't think this will last for very much longer because it's got no steam at all. So thanks for your patience. I've probably rambled a lot there, but I hope it makes some semblance of sense. Thanks, Brian, for tolerating me.
Okay, Mike, do you want to respond to that by Andrew?
No, thanks, no.
Oh, right, okay. Paddy, that's in line now. Okay, Paddy, over to you.
Thanks. I was going to say one thing. I was going to ask one question for Mike. But then Darren asked a question that I thought, I could say something on that. And then Andy's just said something, which I think, I want to say something on that as well. So can I start with, Andy's point, which, I totally sympathise with. I really do this whole idea of atomisation and individuation and have we lost sight of the class war. But I think there's another side to this. There certainly are people on the left who've made sort of identity politics into a sort of, it's a bit of a bandwagon. But I don't think that's wholly true. Are the left defending identity politics instead of class, or are people on the left simply standing up against right wingers who are determined to victimise minorities? Because that is what the right wing does; it victimises minorities. And some people on the left are just going, no, we're not going to allow that. We're going to oppose that. If you walk down the street and you see a bunch of muggers beating up a woman in a wheelchair, in fact, let's make it better. Let's make her a black woman and a lesbian in a wheelchair. And you weigh in to stop the muggers. Does that mean that you've lost sight of the class war? No, of course it doesn't. It means that you're trying to stop a bunch of twats victimising a helpless person. So I think that would be my take on identity politics. Just going on to what Darren asked about, how does this algorithm work? He almost made it sound like it was a sort of, I think Darren said sinister algorithm. I think the algorithms are sort of artificial intelligence. They work on probabilities, very much like language models, like ChatGPT. It works on probabilities. If you watch this video, the probability is that you're quite like this other related video. How exactly they categorize these is probably a industry secret, but that's kind of how it works. And I started to get Jordan Peterson feeds in my YouTube after I watched a film critic who is very good actually, but a bit right wing, and he's quite down on, not entirely incorrectly, by the way. He's very down on sort of woke politics, sort of being crowbarred into films, and to the expense of plot and characterization and this sort of thing. So I say not wrong at all in some cases. Those kind of things. Politics of any sort crowbarred into a film can really ruin the film. So he's quite right. But because I watch those, then I start getting Jordan Peterson. And Jordan Peterson, by the way, he's not strongly right-wing. I mean, he's kind of fairly palatable right-wing compared to some of them. But, I mean, the thing about these algorithms is, let's remember, you can train them. You yourself can train them. You can choose to watch certain things which will teach the algorithm the sorts of things that you like and want to watch. And plus, you can also subscribe to certain channels. One very good one that people here would probably quite enjoy is Lucky Black Cat. She's American. She does sort of socialist communist politics. She's very sort of au fait with, I think, our sort of type of politics, as well as being familiar with all the kind of Leninist ideas, and she doesn't confuse the two. Lucky Black Cat's very good. You know, there is good stuff out there, but you don't always get served up to it if you just go in and watch old sitcoms from the 80s and things like that. You do have to sort of root around, but they are there. Finally, to Mike, can I just say thank you very much for that talk, and thank you for watching all these obnoxious right-wing quasi-fascist twats just so that the rest of us don't have to. You really took a bullet for the rest of us there, Mike. Thank you. I want to ask you just what your opinion is. You mentioned TikTok towards the end. I was wondering if you were going to mention TikTok, because things I've been reading about TikTok, they've absolutely dwarfed all the opposition. The views that people get on TikTok are gigantic compared to what you would get on YouTube, Insta, Facebook, all these sort of things. Absolutely enormous. And this is causing social concern governments are paying attention because of the, these things can cause and have caused riots. You know, they've blown up over, sort of quite innocuous things in some cases. But what I want you to ask is this, where you've got a trend like with TikTok, the trend seems to be towards ever shorter attention spans. Like the average thing on TikTok is what, 10 seconds, 15 seconds, something like that. Well, you've got that on one side, and then you've got the threat from AI engulfing the world in a deluge of fake news, which is what everybody is sort of predicting. You're looking at a generation now, I mean, Gen Z and the one that comes after, that isn't used to concentrating for longer than 20 seconds and also has absolutely no idea what's true and what isn't. OK, when you've got a combination of those two things, dubious information overload and an inability to concentrate, where do you think all this is going, Mike? Because what I wonder is if it's going to lead to a sort of media burnout, a whole generation burning out with all this stuff and just, effectively throwing their phones in the bin and saying, stuff this, this is a waste of time. I'm going to go and meet some real people and have some real conversations. Maybe that's optimistic. Don't know. See what, Mike, what do you think? Thank you.
Paddy there asking him to respond. Mike, will it respond?
Yeah, cheers, yeah. I haven't looked on TikTok very, very much, because I didn't want to contaminate myself too much after, as I say, sort of digesting stuff, mostly on YouTube. I suppose what I was going to say, I'll answer your question, Paddy. I'll try to, but on the whole algorithm thing, on YouTube, I haven't subscribed to any right wing stuff. I deliberately haven't, but it's still cropped up. But again, obviously, I've watched the stuff, and then that sort of feeds into the algorithm, and it's pushing out clips from "Are You Being Served?" or or Human League videos. I probably could sort of train the algorithm a bit better. On Twitter, I've subscribed to a few left wing channels, and I haven't had right wing content come up on Twitter at all, I don't think. And same with Facebook, although these days fewer people seem to be using Facebook. And I go on there a lot. I look at stuff. I don't tend to like or comment on stuff, but Facebook now seems to be mostly adverts, and that seems to be where Facebook's heading, more towards adverts. So I think Facebook's still very popular, especially outside Europe and America. I don't think Facebook's sort of declining globally. Maybe it's sort of declining in the West. A bit. So, but yeah, I suppose my point was, although the right wing stuff has cropped up on the algorithm on YouTube, it hasn't for me on Twitter and Facebook. And as I haven't really gone on to YouTube very much, because I do associate that with, you know, sort of short videos of teenagers giving their opinions, which might be completely unfair to TikTok, but that's sort of what I associate it with. I did wonder if where the future was heading was more towards what Snapchat does, which I've used a bit, but I think the thing with Snapchat is that when something's posted through Snapchat, it's got a very short lifespan. You can't sort of go back and view something on Snapchat from a while ago. I think it's more of a sort of messaging thing rather than a social media thing. So I did wonder if, because of concerns such as, you know, you post something when you're drunk 10 years ago, and then an employer scrolls through your feed, notices something a bit dodgy, and then you don't get the job. So I think there's been some concerns about, you know, once something's posted on social media, it's there forever, and it will come back to haunt you when you're a bit more when you're a bit older. And I think some of those concerns, which took a while to evolve on social media, have led to Snapchat being a sort of a temporary thing. But yeah, it hasn't really sort of dominated, I don't think. Whereas TikTok seems to be the big one, doesn't it? But I think again, aren't there concerns that TikTok is Chinese owned, and therefore it could be a way of harvesting lots of data, which would be of use to the Chinese state. I think there's that concern about TikTok. But yeah, as for where things are heading, it seems to be away from posting videos of old stuff, and more towards the sort of atomization and division that Andy was mentioning. And there are so many of these right-wing alt-tech platforms. There were loads that I didn't mention, you know, that have got very sort of short, weird names, and surely that the market's being saturated with those, and they've got a much smaller reach. But they can't aim for mass appeal, because they, you know, they narrow down to the right. So I suppose what you could get is that as the market develops, a lot of the smaller ones get pushed out, you know, just with the way that that things tend to sort of move towards grouping towards larger entities, you know, in the way that Facebook and Twitter dominated social media. So there's that. But I can't really see right-wing platforms dominating in the future, because their reach, although it's grown, it's never going to be as massive as more sort of neutral, for want of a better word, platforms like Facebook. So yeah, I'll stop, because I'm starting to ramble. Yeah, I'm not quite sure where the future lies. So I did think it would be more towards the sort of the transient social media post, but it doesn't seem to have gone that way there. So sorry, yeah, I don't really have a particular prediction of the future, and hopefully others will have instead. Yeah, but yeah, thanks anyway.
Thanks for that, Mike. All right, Joy has got her hand up. Okay, Joy, over to you, love. Joy?
Yeah, it's not Joy, it's Howard, actually, Brian.
All right.
Simple question. Mike, you talked about governments using troll farms. First of all, can you explain what troll farms are? And secondly, when you talk about governments, are you talking about governments like the British government or your American government, or are these troll farms used by other kinds of governments of the type we might know?
Oh, cheers. Yeah. Yeah, it's a bit of a throwaway mention of a much bigger topic. And I think in one of my older propaganda articles a while back, I sort of looked into sort of troll farms much more. States like Russia and China certainly have troll farms, which are, you know, big office blocks full of banks of computers with people paid to just sit there online all day, creating accounts, posting provocative stuff in reply to others, just to troll and spread propaganda and division. And I think part of the aim of that, which I think is successful, is to divert political discourse away from meaty political discourse of the kind that we're interested in, into the whole kind of sort of sniping between various varieties of identity politics. There's a list on Wikipedia of which states are known to run troll farms. So, there's the usual suspects, Russia, China. I'll maybe look it up a bit later, but I think there's a list of maybe about a dozen or 20 states that are known to have troll farms. Mostly the sort of on the dodgier states, but it's a real recognised thing. It's just sort of a modern form of propaganda that I suppose in some way it's been that kind of propaganda has been around for many decades. I think during the Second World War, sort of leaflets were dropped from planes to stir with comments to stir up division. It's sort of the modern equivalent of that, really. But they're a real thing. I'll look up, and if the conversation hasn't gone in another direction, I'll maybe roll off a list of states that run troll farms. Cheers.
Right. Andrew wants to come back into the conversation. Okay, Andrew.
Thanks. Some interesting comments buzzing around at the moment on this. I was intrigued, actually, and quite thought-provoked, but in a very good way, actually, by what Paddy had said about the way that this phenomenon is speeding up, and certainly with TikTok. I've heard of TikTok. I even get adverts coming onto my computer that I don't want to see on TikTok. Here comes Eileen. But the thing about it is it makes you wonder, actually, like for kids, young people, etc. I'm long enough in the tooth now. I remember, this isn't about social media, but think about it. Things come into fashion, things go out of fashion. There are eras that come along, and things that were cool once are not so cool anymore. When I was a youngster, having a gold Benson and Hedges packet of fags and a gold lighter or a Zippo lighter was the cool thing to do. Now kids have mobile phones. So I just wonder, whether this thing will just die out, to be honest, whether just the use of what you really need a mobile phone for or a handheld computer, like the smartphone, will just be more like functional and used for that sort of thing rather than all this absolute nonsense. And as Paddy said, people will potentially, and even I have faith in young people, but this idea that they this is all they're going to do and this is how they're going to live forever, well, not forever, but for the rest of their life on Earth, that they'll live in this kind of ever sort of reducing sort of social media landscape. It's not really sustainable, is it? And then the other thing about what Mike has just said as well about the propaganda's always been around. Propaganda's always been out there. There's just ways of doing it. It used to be aeroplanes dropping leaflets or the National Front meeting on the front car park of the local shopping centre and all that type of thing. It's always been there. So these channels will exist for people to propagate their views, and that's quite useful actually for us as well. But it's not something necessarily to be too worried about. And Quite honestly, I'm finding this a very, very interesting discussion, but certainly from the perspective of not over worrying about, you know, the kids. I think the kids are all right. I think they'll get on top of it all, actually, and just realise after a while it's a bit boring, isn't it? Let's just get on with life. Thanks, Brian.
That's okay. Right, for those of you who's interested, 70's kindly put into the chat. Just click on the chat and you've got a link there to Troll Farms. So there you go. If you're interested in anything about Troll Farms, just go into the chat and get the link. Right. Next up is Freddie. Freddie wants to have a little chat. Okay, Fred, away you go.
Thanks, Brian. I think the first thing I'd like to say is it can be well seen that Andrew must be pretty much a Who fan, because he mentioned the Who in one of his addresses earlier on there, and then he ends up with "the kids are all right." Now, I wonder where he got that one from. "The kids are all right." If I recall correctly, it was the Who that sang that. I might be wrong. But anyway, on a more sort of serious note, I mean, it has been said this, that sort of left and right wing, etc., have been on the go for many, many, many years. And the only difference now, I feel, is that that with the advent of social media and the means to communicate across the world now, in virtually seconds on occasions, it gives a far greater platform. But the messages are still seem to be pretty consistent. I mean, if you go back to people like, you know, before the advent of social media and the propaganda that was being espoused by the people, that the likes of the Hitlers and the Mussolinis, etc., of this world, and even before that, on the troubles and who's causing troubles, etc., it's nothing unusual. I mean, I don't believe it's anything unusual, and it's only because of the extent now, the ability for people to communicate in a far easier way than historically. I mean, you know, some of the press, the allegedly sort of left-wing Daily Mirror or the sort of liberal, the Guardian, or the right-wing, the Times or the Sun or whatever it might be. None of this is really unusual. I mean, it's been going on for really as far back as I can remember. It's just, as I say, I feel that it's far easier now for these, whatever groups it may be, to try and get some sort of message across, as distasteful as what it is on occasions. But I'd just like to pick up on this thing, though, about Russell Brand. Yeah, Russell Brand. And the castigation that he's getting currently. Now, I remember some time ago now, there was somebody done an article in the Standard, I'm sure it was in the Standard, about Russell Brand. And at that time, I hear what Mike was saying about moving away to the conspiracy theory and such like. But there's little doubt that Russell Brand was what we'd maybe describe as left-wing leaning, that he has some sort of conscious or quite a degree of consciousness about capitalism. And I felt that to some extent, and this is no way, so I don't want him to jump back at me here, to say that I'm implying in any shape or form that some of his behaviour has been less than tolerable. That certainly seems to be the case. It's been less than tolerable. But I was actually talking to somebody yesterday about this. We just get into a conversation. And I actually said to this individual that I was talking to, it's not the first time that people who are maybe on the left that are seen as maybe a bit of a threat to sort of mainstream media or mainstream thinking. And apparently Russell Brand's got about 6 million or so followers. I think actually the figure was quoted, that they will, some people will go out of their way. I believe some people will go out of their way, some of the right wing in particular will go out of their way to castigate individuals that are left-wing leaning. So without any shape or form, I think there may be an element of truth that is, whether these things sort of come up and then 10, 15, 20 years later, somebody's getting for something which apparently was well known at the time. And then these companies that were employing sort of people suddenly then want to pull back from it also. So, you know, I do get a bit concerned at times that when people are being castigated in that way, what is the real reason for it? What is the real reason for it? Because papers like The Sun and such like, which used to show, well, not just The Sun, various papers, Red Label papers, I think they were called, showing women in a state of undress. But then it was sort of wise to that this wasn't the right thing to do. So, you know, but as I say, for me, it's nothing unusual about this left and right. It's been going on for many, many, many years. Thank you.
Okay, next up on the platform is Dougie. There we go, Doug.
Yeah, I mean, I think just recently Rupert Murdoch sort of handed over control of his empire to his son or whatever. I saw Owen Jones on Sky, and they asked Owen Jones what he thought of Rupert Murdoch, and he just laid into Rupert Murdoch, saying he was homophobic during the AIDS thing. He supported the war in Iraq and things like that. And then, you know, I mean, he supported Donald Trump, but I mean, he probably doesn't like Donald Trump because he lost a lot of money. He was Fox News supporting his claim that the election was rigged, and then they had to pay $700 million litigation. Yeah. So, but I mean, there's been these rich people owning the media, and they tend to be right wing, right? You know, and I know there's the Mirror in this country and the Guardian and things, but most of the papers are owned by billionaires, and they've got an agenda, right? You know, and I mean, they said that he helped get Tony Blair elected, right? Because he moved over to supporting Tony Blair at the time of the election in '97, when Tony Blair got a landslide victory or whatever. And I mean, Rupert Murdoch was blamed. Well, he took some of the credit for that, right? Yeah, yeah. So. And I mean, you've got GB News now in this country. I mean, I've watched it sometimes. They sometimes have the token left person on. This is a right wing agenda, right? It's supporting right wing views or whatever, you know. And they scapegoat people, immigrants and things like that. And they're quite nasty with it, really. Yeah. I actually saw them trying to defend Liz Truss, what her policies were when she just about crashed the economy or whatever. So anyway, I think a lot of it's to do with billionaires owning the media. And I know you've got all these other people that that Mike's talked about, but the mainstream seems to be, you know, people who read the Telegraph and the Times and the Sun and, you know, all the papers that are owned by Rupert Murdoch and other people like him or whatever. Yeah.
You finished that, Dougie?
Yeah, I've had my rant, yeah.
Okay, right. Next up is Darren again. Okay, Darren, over to you.
Hi there. Can I just quickly reply to what Freddie was saying about the suggestion that Russell Brand has been possibly targeted by whoever because he's seemingly speaking truth to power and he's seen as a threat? I'm sorry. I understand that the party, you know, if you look at back issues of the Standard, there was a period around about 2013, 2014, where seemingly Russell Brand, because of a particular interview he did with Jeremy Paxman, was seemingly quite radical, you know, maybe described himself as an anarchist who ended up endorsing Ed Miliband on the eve of the 2015 general election. But the Russell Brand of that period and the Russell Brand of 2023, there's a real shift there. You know, and you know, I don't want to say anybody wants to kind of say maybe Brand is being targeted. Please look at what this guy has been saying for the last, you know, 4 or 5 years. This guy is definitely in deep, balls deep, you know, no, don't use that expression, with the right now. You know, this is a guy who has friendly chats with Tucker Carlson, has friendly follow-ups with Donald Trump Jr. And he's positioned himself, he's pivoted himself as this kind of counter-cultural, you know, anti-establishment character who appeals as much to the right as he ever did to the supposed left. And it's kind of, you know, for those of you who don't, you know, go on social media, the people who basically came out and defended Brand after this, Sunday Times investigation, Dispatches investigation, was the likes of Andrew Tate, was the likes of Elon Musk. You know, this guy, you know, at worst is a rapist, at best is a sex, at least worst is a sex pest. You know, and this idea that he was taken down because he was seemingly too much of a threat. You know, where's the sex scandal for Bernie Sanders? You know, whatever your opinion about Bernie Sanders' politics, the reality was Bernie Sanders is far greater threat to elements of the capitalist class than Russell Brand ever was. You know, the guy, admittedly, the guy has 6 million subscribers, etc., on various social media platforms. But that's nothing. That's nothing. You know, I mean, it means a lot because it's we're looking at it. But that's nothing. But please don't fall into that conspiracy rabbit hole of thinking that Brand was somehow taken down because he was saying something, speaking the truth. The guy's a scumbag, you know. He's been caught out, you know. You know, unfortunately, the signs were there even when the Socialist Standard was carrying articles about some of the things he was saying. I think he's, I mean, I've not said the word yet, but he's also a grifter as well. He's found his grift. He's found his audience, you know, on the right, you know, and he's been able, because he's quite articulate and he's quite photogenic, he's been able to kind of like, you know, take this position of this kind of touchy-feely conspiracy loon green, you know, spirituality bullshit. You know, please don't fall for this guy. Thank you. That's my rant.
Thank you, Darren. Right. So many hands.
Brian, if I could help you out, I think it was Howard actually that had the hand up first.
Yes, it's definitely Howard is next in line. Thank you, Howard.
Okay, right. Just really in response to something that Dougie said. Dougie was talking about how the mainstream press are inevitably right-wing, the Times, the the Telegraph, the Mail, etc., and so on and so forth. And this is one of the things, this is one of the reasons why you've got this sort of strong right-wing thrust to, you know, to sort of public discourse and so on. It may be the case, but what you've got to bear in mind is that ever since the end of the Second World War, the mainstream press has been right-wing. It supported the Tories and not the Labour Party. If people were that influenced by what the press says, there would not have been any Labour governments, and there have been quite a few since the war. I know the Tories have been in for longer, but there's not that much in it. Yet, you know, on a good number of occasions, regardless of what the media have said, Labour's been elected, as they probably will be next year, even though the majority of the mainstream press are going to be saying, don't touch them with a barge pole, support the Tories. So I think it's possible to, you know, go over the top on that one, to exaggerate the impact that the media, in particular the mainstream media, have on the political opinions of people. By the political opinions, of, I mean, you know, whether to vote for Tweedledum or Tweedledee.
Sorry, I was muted there. Next is Andrew again. Thank you.
Well, thanks. This has been a great discussion actually tonight. So I'm so grateful for everybody's contributions and to have the ability to hear them. I suppose two things here I'd just like to say quickly. Dougie, people do read the right-wing media, the right-wing papers. I actually, for my multiple sins, have a subscription to the Daily Telegraph. I find it very thought-provoking because, obviously, most of the time, it gives you an insight into the real workings of the establishment and the Tory party. But it also sort of like, you know, really kind of gets me going because I think, oh, you know, I completely disagree with this. And isn't that a load of bull, you know, and all the rest of it. So there's that side of it. And I've forgotten what else I wanted to say. So thanks.
Okay, there. Next is Mike Woodsarverwood. Mike, may I just point out to you the time? It's 5 to 9, somewhere around there. Could you also make this contribution to sum it up, please?
I didn't think to sum it up. I suppose my point was really just to sort of thank Darren for his contribution earlier about Russell Brand. Yeah, I think you're sort of spot on there, and I think the whole Russell Brand thing is a bit of a sort of, I don't know, test case, but that's probably not quite the right word, but sort of an example of how you know, the reactions to things sort of overtake or overwhelm, you know, the original accusations, in that you know, you can sort of sit back and watch the toing and froing between people supporting or disagreeing with Russell Brand. And I think because of the way that he himself has bounced between left and right and different views. And, you know, as Darren said, he's done that in order to, you know, for attention's sake, you know, to make himself appear more relevant among a different section of the of his potential audience. So, yeah, he's just chased after something which he perceived as edgy. But yeah, it's all a front. It's all in order to publicise himself, rather than publicise a particular viewpoint. And I think because of the way he's bounced between right and left, it sort of confused some of the discourse about him, and it's probably led to some of those conspiracy theories, because some people don't quite know where to place him, because, you know, is he right wing, is he left wing, and that led to an on-air spat between two GB news presenters. In that, rather weirdly, that that there was a man and a woman, both GB news presenters, and the woman was defending brand, but the man wasn't, and you know, the man was saying, you know, well, his behaviour, whether or not it leads to any criminal convictions, has been reprehensible. So yeah, even GB News is divided over over what brand says. And I think that confusion as to where to place brand among some people online has led to these conspiracy theories. That there was one that he deliberately moved rightwards, knowing that these allegations were going to come out, because if he moved to the right, he'd then know he'd get more people defending him against these accusations by aligning himself with the right and with people who are likely to you know, criticise the women accusing him, likely to feed into that it's all some big pharma conspiracy against him. So you start wading through some mess of opinions, and it's difficult to know what the origin of that opinion was, because it's been put through the ringer, bouncing back between left and right, and you just get some confusing mess, which is the kind of thing that troll farms do, to be honest. They're there to sow division and sow discord. Although I suppose you could say that, you know, that in itself is a conspiracy theory, that, you know, if you accept that troll farms and trolls carry a lot of weight, that in itself is a conspiracy theory. So again, you end up in this whole mess of responses to various positions on the identity politics front, which it distracts from what the real issue is, which is, you know, as we know, you know, class struggle and focusing on critiquing and then overthrowing capitalism. So yeah, it's all a diversion, really. Not that I'm saying that my talk was a diversion away from the important stuff, but hopefully I've helped to clarify the mess, if that's not a contradiction. Yes, I don't know if that counts as summing up, and I'll be happy for the discussion to continue. But yeah, it's bang on 9 o'clock, so you know, if that's the evening done, then so be it. But yeah, thanks everyone for listening, and I'll purge my polluted mind of lots of right wing nonsense by watching an episode of Blake 7, maybe. I might put that on later on. But yeah, thanks anyway, everyone. Cheers.
Thank you, Mike. Right. I don't know what's up for or planned for next week. Adam, can you fill us in on that? Anything for next week, Adam?
Brian, Howard here. I'm afraid it's me next week, speaking about human nature.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I confirm.
Right, so there we are. We got Howard Moss next week speaking about human nature.
I don't know whether you've got the actual title, Adam. I haven't got it in front of me.
Oh, okay.
So, right. The title is How Big an Obstacle Are Ideas About Human Nature to the Spread of Socialist Ideas?
Okay, that is the title. You're right, Adam. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I remember now. Yeah. Okay.
There we go. Okay, then, folks. Till next week. Take care.
Thanks. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks very much.
Cheers, guys.
Night. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye. Bye. Thank you. Bye. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks, Mike.